Good. So we're going to look at the coordination of time and space. And since we know that the technosphere relies on a highly coordinated version of time and space, we've just seen that in Julian's talk, we will be looking from the outside a little bit more. So at least I will look at the coordination of space from the other side of standardization. And if we look at a body like this, for example, the echelon of the kilogram, and what it does with the German colony of Papua New Guinea, I think we get a very good idea what it means to be subjected to a binary logic or to be made addressable for the first time. Because every time you need data or you produce data, first of all, what you have to do is to produce units. And what is a space that is not used or prepared to produce units? So the idea is that the space is altered by a process that I call mesuroclasm, and I will get into that. The protectorate of German New Guinea existed for a mere 30 years. The people lived in acephalous societies without stable political centers, without rating systems, and without general purpose monies. My claim is that the space of these islands is altered by the introduction of the metric system, which both mirrors and facilitates the interest of bookkeepers. Metrication is a crucial process preparing the soil for the advent of the technosphere and subjecting the space to a binary logic. The introduced system makes the space operational. To spread the quantification, it depends on an invisible presence of standards to gauge, unify, commensurate, and transcribe. All of this silently alters what Karl Polanyi calls the monetary sphere of the cultures colonized. A space that is neither fully imaginary or nor solid infrastructure. So it's really the question, where is this metrication situated? And it's not really infrastructure in the sense that matter that moves matter is happening here. But on the other hand, it's more solid and more of a protocol than just an idea or imaginary system. So I think it consists of rules, of measuring scales, and of practices used by different cultures to build equivalences and exchange of values. So it's very much an economic problem, I would say. And there's a lot to standardize. The South Pacific is considered to have the highest density and plurality of economic institutions. It was here that economic anthropology developed with Bronislaw Malinowski and Richard Thornwald. Instead of a binary logic or the octagonal system used by IBM mainframes, the counting system in the region could be based on the number 27, for example. In the Oxum language, the number 27 is the basis, and there's a body part tallying system going along with this fashion of counting, so it's quite a difference. Glendon Lean has tried to map the counting system for the whole region, that is Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia, and he counts up to 900 counting systems and 741 different languages, so and even if that might be a bit exaggerated, we are still safe to say that it's a very plural region. For any local officer of the German New Guinea company, metrication would be a process very difficult to translate. And what people would use to measure things, and especially for symbolic measures, looks like this. Parts of the Kaiserreich used this pearl money from Palau, which could buy anything from love to power, but not subsistence goods. Some regions used dog teeth or red feathers. This is a shell money called diavara, shell chains which were measured in arm's length or hand's length. It was so effective that the decrees forbid for the colonial personnel to use it. So there was a tendency to use rather this diavara than the New Guinean mark, and this is a very, very important indication for what Bloch and Perry have found out about symbolic measurements and indigenous currencies, that in the procedure of colonization, they might actually thrive or develop. We have an example of this here. I will come back to that. So my main material is really a survey. In 1907, the Reichskolonialamt, Berlin's central agency for the administration of the colonies, requested this survey, asking all the outposts what would happen if here we could insert, I mean, like if we could metricize our colony. And a little time afterwards, it was sent to all the outposts. And this is a strategy that the German colonial ministry uses quite a lot. For example, if they want to know what types of slavery exist in your area, or what is the indigenous law that's being used in your area, they use this kind of questionnaires. And in 1908, there's a letter going back to Berlin saying, yes, we can metricize this space, without the risk is negligible if we metricize this space. And what risk, we may ask, of course, there's the British imperial system, so it's an economic question whether you use the German or French one or this British one. It may affect trading. The island of Saipan reports a dependency or a fatal dependency on a scale from Japan. So nobody on the island could really judge with whether the equivalences were fair that they had to construct there. So it was a question, or it was really a good thing to have metric measures and a way to sort of prove what weight there was. But the greatest surprise in the survey that was sent back to Berlin was probably that local colonial official in the Mariana Islands in the Northwest had already started metrication. All foreign weights and measures which are being used after April 1st will be confiscated, is a letter that he circulated. And I would like to dwell on this confiscation a little more, because Fritz was a circumspect patriarch on his island, and if he writes this, we have reason to believe that the measures were physically relinquished and relinquished from sight and destroyed. And this is a cleansing move that the most important part of metrication consists of. It does not only affect competing imperial systems tailored to foreign trade, but it interferes with local practices and institutions. Manuel Stumper concludes that any change in the types of economic measurement is a thorough colonial intervention and should be listed right next to military force or missionary education. The Mexican economic sociologist Hector Vera used the word mesuroclasts in his discussion of the metrication in Middle America. I do not have appropriate images for this time, but since we're gouging administrations all around the world, of course, confiscate measures on a daily basis, I replaced the procedure with pictures from the Philippines while I refer to Hector Vera. His main example is the Quebraquilos revolt in northern Brazil, where the new measures were broken in protest. In the Mexican War of the Pans, a rebellion of the Chatinos in Oaxaca, Vera wanted to see another violation of indigenous measuring practices as core incident. We know from the French Revolution that things like this happened, and in 1768, the Winchester bushel in Tewksbury was publicly burned. So in the Philippines, of course, this is more of a state iconoclasm or a state mesuroclasm, but this is actually parallel or more parallel to the conditions in Papua New Guinea. Vera does not say much about the process of iconoclasm, although it's very parallel to the word he uses. And if we listen or look at the variety of theories available, we may ask with Bruno Latour why the iconoclasts' hammers have always seemed to strike sideways. This is his version of saying that iconoclasm is a very, very interesting operation where you can affect a material thing, but actually the hammer strikes sideways, and that means, in a way, you are actually hitting a symbolic system. So there's this translation going on in an iconoclasm. James Simpson hints at another logic, and that is that there's a kind of cultural hygiene. The kinesis of iconoclasm continues with ever purer, narrower historical affiliations, and it continues until the logic of deconstruction is stabilized. So there's a tendency in iconoclasm to end up with geometrical cleansed forms and probably abstract art. And this is probably the closest to the metroclasm, because that's a movement where you eradicate different systems. So it's a symbolic attack. It has an emptying logic to it. And finally, there's a public dynamic, because once you perform such a metroclasm and it's not, or an iconoclasm, and it's not really clear how the public will react, there's an unknown and unruly element to an iconoclasm. And this means that we do not know if the person's destroying the image or destroying the scales here will succeed, and whether the public sort of allows for the things to be destroyed, or whether it, on the other hand side, makes the older system stronger, migrates the semantics to a less vulnerable material. So I give you one last example, and this is from the island of Yap. They had a very special way of showing and measuring the different values in their society. These large stone discs constitute a ceremonial currency, and the value is discerned by diameter and was measured in a very international unit, known as the span of a hand. The lower echelons of the island society were forbidden to own stones larger than 4 spans. Old discs could have specific names, and it's impossible to move these objects alone. And this is probably why the stone money of Yap had a second career in economic theory, because it was a very, very good example of a fiat currency. People wouldn't move the discs, they would just record and keep in mind their value and how the value was transferred. And there was nothing backing these currencies, so it was only really in the society that lived by them where they had their reality. Expedition, so to obtain the material, there is another method of measurement involved. And because the material couldn't be found on the island itself, expeditions of adventurers are formed, and these have to travel 500 kilometers across the ocean to the island of Ponape. And for this, they use a special navigation technique, so it's another way of measuring space that belongs to what to the most sophisticated examples of non-Western knowledge. Hard work and dangers of transportation have to be endured to bring back the artifacts which were crucial to the prestige and the social hierarchy on the island. But it would be wrong to consider metrication a linear procedure of replacement. Ceremonial currencies usually begin to thrive and take a stronger meaning, or can take a stronger meaning when when they are threatened by colonization. The same can be observed for the other side. So the colonial officials, of course, start to use or make use of this measure of value too. And what they did, for example, is use a steamship to transport them. And then we have another problem, and this problem is really inflation, because of course these discs became larger and larger, and this is of course dangerous to their value and dangerous to the social structure of the society they belong to. And the colonial officials would go, on the other hand, and pawn some of these. If they pawned them, they would have two letters for Bezirksamt, B and A, just written in black color on the stones. And once that was the case, it didn't belong to the official owner anymore. And this is another way of dealing and becoming a stone plate capitalist in a way that the colonial administration used. So what I was trying to demonstrate is how metrication really interferes with all the economic institutions on these islands, and they're very, very, very plural. For example, the Septemvigesimal system that I was referring to, that was based on the 27, faded out in the 1940s. And we have, of course, other reactions. The Mariana Islands aren't metricized, and the cargo cults.